action of Rodgers, Blair Box, Ivan Ljubicic, wife Mirka, everyone sharing in that joy.
The player's box, Remo, is something we all know, but something we see if we watch tennis. What exactly is it?
Well, I think it's something we take for granted, but something that over the years has literally become an extension of the player. We expect them to have a coterie of people in the box, watching them, supporting them, riding the match, and we in turn ride the emotions of what's going on in that box.
Some players obviously rely on the box far more than others.
For sure. For example, Federer hardly looks at his box. Nick Kyrgios, for him, it's absolutely crucial. And the Nick Kyrgios box is an interesting one because the pressure within the Kyrgios box is intense.
Yeah.
Not only are you expected to stand at the right time, applaud in the right manner, fist pump at the appropriate time, but if Nick Kyrgios doesn't believe that the gesture that you're coming up with is appropriate at that point in the match, he'll let you have it. So there is a lot of pressure to perform in the box.
It's interesting. I think for someone who goes to watch Kyrgios, they must be keenly aware of that. I know in one match, he shouted at them, "You had one job." Now, whatever that was, I don't know if it was to do with a drink or racket or something, but another time, I think he admonished someone for not standing at the right time and clapping and being supportive enough. Now, obviously, if you're in the box, your job there is to support and be there for the player.
And Kyrgios is watching. He's playing a match, but he's also watching all of this in his box. So he's almost got his eyes on the match and he's got his eyes on the box. And that's a lot of pressure for Kyrgios.
I've got a quote here, Remo. I think that probably speaks to what you're saying. It's from Patrick Mouratoglou, who is Serena Williams' coach. And he said, "It's crazy because this box is like the center of attraction of their eye, the player, throughout the whole match. The players watch between every point, and even the ones who say they don't, they do. They try to hide it. Some people think this is a weakness from the player because they're looking for help. They're not looking for help. Some do, but they're sharing. They're sharing their emotion. That's the first thing they do when they enter the court. They look at the box and they have in their mind a photograph of the box, who's there, and everything." Basically, he's saying that every player knows who's in the box at every point, which is really fascinating.
They want to feel assured. It's like a safety net for them in some ways. They're not going out there alone because tennis court one-on-one can be a very lonely place, I think, as Andre Agassi has often said. And to know that you have people in the box supporting you must be some great comfort to you.
When we talked about this topic for the podcast, I had assumed throughout my tennis watching life that players are in such a bubble of what they're doing that they're only aware of the player's box in very certain circumstances. But it seems to me that they're very, very aware of it. And we've got some examples coming up later of very specific instances where the box influenced the match.
Yes.
In very specific ways. Rather than go into that, maybe we should go to someone who in some ways popularized, democratized the player's box.
I wasn't sure what was going on. There was people coming on the court and there was red carpet coming out. I had my trainer, I had my dad, you know, my girlfriend, my sister was there. You know, I had a whole group of people. I couldn't stand it anymore, you know. Off I went. Started climbing up seats, and that was fine. That was no problems. But then I got to an area which they don't have anymore in the centre court, which is a big standing room only area.
Well, there he goes, up to the box.
I didn't know what to do. I thought, oh my God, I've come all this way, and I thought, I can't turn back now. And there was a guy dressed up as a priest, and I didn't know if he was a real one or not. But anyway, I stood on his shoulder to get across to the commentary box.
I've never seen that before, but that's a marvellous moment for him.
Maybe I should have planned it out a bit better before I started hitting off, but I wasn't thinking too clearly then.
And there's father with him and all the family. Well,
to my father, I couldn't say anything. I was just, it was too much for me.
Well, now, how's he coming down?
It did set a precedent, didn't it? Because other people have done it. But he was the first, the original and best.
I remember that moment vividly, Pat Cash climbing up into the player's box and starting what has since become a tradition. at Wimbledon, to the point where eventually Wimbledon protocolized the march up to the box by the winner by clearing a path. Reason for that, Buzz, was I think on that first climb up from Pat Cash, he left a carnage of injuries behind him. Broken fingers, bruised ears, dislocated a couple of shoulders on the way up there. But he got there, as I say, basically created a tradition then and there on the spot.
It's amazing when you watch it now, because we're used to seeing the players now going up with a clear passageway to get to the player's box. And as you said, he had to virtually tread on people's laps, on their shoulders, you know, on old women's heads, that kind of thing, just to get up there. For a moment there, there was a question as to whether he would actually be able to get to the box. He seemed a bit stuck.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like an obstacle course for him.
It was. He did well after beating Lendl in that final to be able to muster up the energy to do that. I've also heard stories that it's almost a parallel with the scene in Crocodile Dundee at the end there, where Crocodile Dundee is climbing over the top of people's heads in the subway in New York, and there was talk that there was some connection there as well. I don't know. Did the image lodge in his subconscious and then spill out that day at Wimbledon?
Well, in Crocodile Dundee, when Paul Hogan climbs over the top of the commuters, it's sort of a reference to sheep.
That's right.
In Australia. So is Pat Cash basically saying to Wimbledon that he considered them all sheep and he was going to climb over the top? I don't think so.
No.
I don't think so. I think it was a spur of the moment thing.
But what he did too, Buzz, was dictate where the cameras that day would be going. They had to follow Cash, and they followed him right to the player's box. And we were introduced to his coach, his father, his psychologist. And I also wonder if that was the start of a rivalry that began between the player's box and the royal box that day, Buzz.
At Wimbledon
At Wimbledon only. And I'm wondering if the royals at the time would have had a few quiet words to each other and been aware of the fact that the limelight had been taken away from them and had been cast onto the player's box.
To begin with, I think when the members of the All England Tennis Club saw him doing that, and they were a very conservative club.
I believe some of the members wanted to call the police and have him arrested.
Yeah, taken away in handcuffs.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're nicked, mate. He's out the back. But again, you're right. The royal box, when the royalty comes, it's a big moment. Mm-hmm. Even the players go out and they bow to the box. They still do that.
Well, they still do that. But what about when there are no royals in the box and they still bow to an empty box? What's that about?
Do they feel stupid? Do they turn around and bow and look at them and go, well, what the hell, who am I bowing to? Well, Rod Laver?
You'd think Pete they Sampras? Could have, very least put some cardboard cutouts in there if they can't make it in person, so that you're not just bowing to thin air.
Yeah, you look up, then there's Michael Parkinson behind there, and that's all it is.
Well, he's almost royalty.
I was going to say, when Pat Cash did the climb, and you're right, the television cameras were forced to follow him. He's the Wimbledon champion. Mm. It's almost as if he used his newfound power to break a rule, and they had to go with it.
Yeah.
If he tried in some other way at the All England Club to do something that was against the rules, they could have put the kibosh on it very quickly. But this is the Wimbledon champion. This is a moment at Wimbledon that they had no control over. And Pat Cash, being the Aussie he is, went, well, hey, I'm going to take advantage of this. Climbed up. I don't care about the rules.
Yeah. He could have done anything. Say he decided to start dancing. A 5-minute dance on centre court. Who's going to stop him? He's the Wimbledon champion.
Exactly.
And the cameras will be on him.
Exactly. If they went to the crowd, they'd just be responding to what he's doing. So it would have been ridiculous.
And people at home are saying, well, where's Cash? We want to see Cash. Cash is dancing. Show us Cash.
Exactly. Show us Cashy. What if he had a bazooka in his bag? No one knows. Would he get frisked on the way in? He could have done anything.
What,
any sort of damage.
Fired it off in some kind of victory salute at the end there.
Yeah, taken off the clock at the top.
Interesting.
Do you know that it's not the only thing that Pat Cash introduced, I believe?
Really?
I don't know if you're aware of this, Reema. Mm. The year before at Wimbledon, Pat Cash took off his headband and his wristbands and threw them into the crowd. And I believe that's the first time that was done. Pat Cash won one Open, one Slam. Mm. But his influence over tennis, in a broader sense, is actually quite marked for the viewer experience.
Okay, so that is the first time that a tennis player has taken off some of their clothing and thrown it into the crowd. Is that what you're saying?
I don't know about clothing.
Right.
I think, though, the headband and the wristband, what they've worn during the match, and people would clamour over them, you know, push young kids down to grab a headband.
Yes.
But I believe that was the first time. I read this. It's not verified. Hmm. Ladies and gentlemen, don't take this verbatim. I could be totally wrong. But if it is, in two consecutive years, Pat Cash changed the course of the way we watch tennis and experience tennis.
Besides losing early the next year, did he do anything in 88?
Well, he was waiting. He had something for the semifinals you wouldn't believe.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, but he didn't quite get there. There you go. Since that time, that climb is done all the time.
Yes.
Not at every Open, because there's no pathways. At the Australian Open, for example, at the top of this podcast, we heard Roger Federer's box go up. Now, Federer went over there, and he had to reach up to them. I don't know if you remember.
He did. There was some talk that there was going to be an installation of a flying fox where you could climb up and basically glide in to your player's box after the victory.
Yeah, well, they did a test on it, and Fred Stolle was the guy who did it, and he fell and broke his hip. That's not true. Okay. Now, Pat Cash, when he went up into the stand, the commentators were so unused to it that they, I think it was Dan Maskell.
And John Barrett?
Yeah, Dan Maskell was the older guy with a very, very thick voice.
Yes.
And he called someone in the box as being Pat Cash's partner, who wasn't Pat Cash's partner. So this goes to show you that would not happen now.
No.
He said, oh, that's Pat Cash's partner. And it was Enebrit, I think, was down the other end.
And who did he call as Pat Cash's partner?
I think it was Patty Jakes.
Well, that's a mistake that could be easily made, Buzz. It happens all the time. And I think Pat was a very, very big Carry On fan.
I am aware that a man has his uncontrollable urges from time to time.
Oh, only at Christmas and bank holidays.
I should really feel very flattered.
Kurt Vallis from coaching, warning, Mrs. Williams.
A major controversy from the 2018 US Open, where Serena Williams lost it in that final against Osaka. The accusation there was that she was being coached, which as it turned out, she was, although unbeknownst to her, things were happening around her that she wasn't aware of. Now, coaches in the box are the focus of the player in that box. It's a tricky relationship, Buzz, in the sense that they've got to be there to show support. Also, the temptation to help your player is sometimes too much for a coach. And it's interesting just looking at how this plays out in all sorts of ways.
You can see with some coaches, the way they hold back their inclination to want to make a hand signal, they'll just fist pump something. And you can just see they want to put so much meaning into that fist pump or into that look they have.
Yeah.
And they're running, you know, on the borderline of going over the edge. The other side of it is the way the coach sits and how he signals his emotion to the player. Some coaches will stand and applaud and egg on their players. Others, and a classic example would be Ivan Lendl with Andy Murray.
Mm.
When he came into the Andy Murray camp, Judy Murray, Andy Murray's mother, was very emotional, quite over the top. When Ivan Lendl took over from Andy Murray, he sat there stone-faced. I don't know if you remember this.
Mm.
And it was almost like a counter to Andy's emotionality on the court. No matter what happened, you just saw Ivan Lendl, stone-faced, keeping it real, keeping it tight. And Andy Murray would shout and do this and do that, but that never wavered from Lendl, and it worked wonders with Murray. Yeah. And he even banned Judy Murray from the box, I think, Ivan Lendl as well.
And Murray eventually lessened that behaviour.
Yeah.
Because I don't know if you ever had the experience where you're shouting at somebody and all you're getting back is a stony look. You eventually pipe down.
It's like a child. It's like dealing with a child. It was brilliant by Lendl. He knew exactly what he had to do. It was a great bit of coaching.
Mm.
Would it have worked with other players? Absolutely not. With some other players, it'd be the worst thing you could do. Because they'd say, well, are you for me here?
Mm.
Yeah, they need the rev up.
Yeah, and that's really important in a relationship between a player and a coach to sort out how that's going to play out.
Yeah.
And it's almost like a secret code that's going on in that box, where, as you were alluding to, things that on the surface don't seem like they're coaching, they are full of intent. An arched eyebrow, for example, could be loosen your grip on the backhand. A scratch on the nose could be your elbow's too high on the serve. And that is a lot of work for a player who's preparing a game plan but also needs to know the codes. It can get very, very complicated, especially if you mistake, if somebody sneezes accidentally. The player could take that as a signal to forfeit the match.
Well, Egon Tyriak had a book It was about 48 pages long of different tics, different expressions, different ways he'd use his hand.
Yeah, beautifully illustrated.
Beautifully illustrated by Chiriac himself. He was a master illustrator, as well as being a master coach.
He was. But very subtle. There have been some coaches who haven't been quite so subtle. I think Larry Stefanke once tried to bring a whiteboard into the player's box and claimed it was a heart monitor for Andy Roddick's mother. Really, nobody bought it.
No one bought that. No.
That was an extreme case. Certainly, I think Stefanke learnt his lesson and then reverted back to his more traditional techniques.
He had to pull it back. He was walking a tightrope there. I think what something you said before, I just want to bring up again here, Remo, between a player and coach, it's almost a fault line, what the player expects from the coach and what he wants and what the coach is willing to give and what he thinks he should be giving. You think that would be a conversation they must have.
Look, it's also riddled with inconsistency, the whole rule, because there is nothing to stop a player taking onto the court a written piece of paper with instructions from their coach, which they could pull out of their bag at any time and read.
Yeah, that's right.
I know Jimmy Connors, for example, used to have a letter from his grandmother stuffed into his sock and he would pull it out. I think he did so in that 75 Wimbledon final against Arthur Ashe. Should that be against the rules?
Exactly. I remember when Pete Sampras went through his dip in 2001, 2002, I think he was being beaten by George Bastl, if you remember, and he pulled a letter out of his bag. I think it was from his fiancée at the time or his partner.
I thought that was a letter from his accountant.
Demanding payment.
Exactly.
Yeah, and you know what?
Well, put the pressure on Sampras. He lost that match and really had panicked because he was sweating on that 20,000. But anyway, when did it start though, Buzz? Bjorn Borg's coach, Leonard Berglund, would have been one of the first to appear in the box and travel. And also Gloria Connors, Jimmy Connors' mother as well.
She was there.
Yes.
As his mother, she's almost expected to be there. So that's an interesting one.
And tennis players are great copycats. You see players like Connors and Borg up there at the top of the mountain. People say, well, what are they doing? Well, they have a coach who travels with them and sits in that box. Oh, that must be what you do.
In the 1980 Wimbledon final, you see Berglund there. You don't see a coach for John McEnroe.
No.
One of the most famous matches ever played. And there's no coach for McEnroe in 1980. Now, fast forward 10 years and you'd be hard-pressed to see a player without a coach
in the box. And some of the coaches who have almost become as well-known as the players.
Well, that's an interesting development. Uncle Tony. Tony Nadal.
Can I just stop you there on Uncle Tony? Now, how has it come to be that the world refers to Tony Nadal as Uncle Tony? Now, correct me if I'm wrong, Buzz, but Uncle Tony is Nadal's uncle. He's not your uncle and he's not my uncle. I think it's interesting how he's almost taken on this larger-than-life avuncular persona for the world. He's Uncle Tony.
Sorry to interrupt you, but do you think it's because he's his uncle, which is unusual, because Rafa's father sometimes is in the box, and so you have to differentiate them. You can't say the guy who looks like Rafa's father is his coach. You know, you've got to Rafa's father's brother. That sounds ridiculous.
Well, why not refer to Rafa's father as Father Nadal and Uncle Tony? We have a differentiation. And another thing, if Tony Roach, the great player and great coach, has a grandchild and that child becomes a professional player and Tony Roach coaches him, do we suddenly refer to him as Grandfather Roach?
Papa Roach.
I don't know. It gets under my skin a little bit.
It's interesting, though, that you say that. Coaches becoming more like, not celebrities, but becoming figures in their own right. You look at Berglund, who was Borg's coach. This guy wasn't there as a celebrity. He was there for Borg. Ewan Tyriac, who was Vilas's coach and then took Becker.
And Nastasi's, I believe.
And Nastasi. So he was one of the first as well.
Yeah, he would have been. Yep.
Yeah. And there for Becker as well. But he was a larger-than-life character. Billionaire, by the way.
Yeah. Did you know? Oh, yeah.
So he had a touch of the celebrity about him. As time has wore on, it seems to me that these coaches, even though their personalities might not be the celebrity type, you think of the Australian Darren Cahill, very laid-back guy. He turned down Roger Federer to be his coach.
Slammed the door in his face, I believe.
Yeah, and said, not now, Feds.
Well, we're going to be joined in this part of the podcast by our great friend, Teddy Shingles. Teddy, I believe you're going to give us an insight into some of the partners in the player's box. Perhaps we can talk about Cisca Perello.
The most beautiful woman in the world.
Yes, and who is, of course, Rafael Nadal's longtime partner.
That's right.
And has been there in the box through thick and thin, riding every emotion.
Well, Ziska, such a natural beauty. She doesn't carry it with her, if you know what I mean. She's just a natural beauty and a naturally beautiful personality. I can see why her and Rafa get on. On the court, Rafa is quite an intense bull.
Mm.
But off the court, gentle.
Yeah, he almost goes from brooding to poetic, from court to off court.
That's right. Yeah. And Ziska has been with him for some time and she doesn't often come to the matches.
Well, no, I'll just stop you there if I may, Teddy, because I believe that Ziska, when she went for the first time to watch Rafa play, she was quite shocked by her experience in the box and she confided in you. And apparently she was not prepared for the regimentation that was expected of her in the Rafa box. We know that Rafa is very regimented with his drink bottles and also apparently in the box where he will dictate who sits where, the position that they need to sit in. Any rather off angle in terms of a lurch forward can play havoc with his game, something that quite shocked her at the time.
It's little known that Rafa does this, and it did shock her. I think the thing that shocked her most was that he had scales put in, two scales, that would weigh the weight of her buttocks as they shifted during the match. And if there was a great discrepancy, a little alarm would go off near where he had his bag, and he'd shoot a look up at her as if to say, "Control those buttocks, woman, otherwise I'll be out of here." And I think she was shocked. She'd never heard him talk in that such a way. It's very hard to control exact pressure of your buttocks. I believe she went away and she practiced, and she said to him, "Rafa, I simply can't do it." And he was disappointed in
her. Well, the dirty looks that Uncle Tony was shooting her every time she shifted buttocks and throwing off his young charge.
Well, Uncle Tony has excellent buttock control. Everyone knows that. When she came down to the 2017 Australian Open, she watched Rafa throughout the entire tournament. It was quite odd for her to come all that way to see. But her stipulation was no buttock scales. I refuse to come down if there are buttock scales. And Rafa reluctantly agreed, but reluctantly. Yes.
Also lost the final and brought it up at the press conference, much to the confusion of the journalist who had no idea what he was talking about.
Well, he used his hands. He had his hands and he was lifting one above the other like this. I suppose you can't see in a podcast. It was as if he was weighing different things. And she understood and she was heartbroken. It's not easy being Rafa's girlfriend in that situation. Well, now fiancé, I believe. Yeah. And I, no one is happier than me. I think they're a wonderful couple as long as the buttock scales are left out of things.
Look, not easy for any of these partners, Teddy. And we're going to end, if you don't mind, because I could keep you here for hours. But if we could just finish off with Mariana and the relationship there between she and Bjorn.
Well, you know my feelings about Mariana. One of the most lovely women in the world, and I still am in contact with her to this day, after all these years. I've talked about this before, Rim. I won't bore you.
It's never boring. Never boring, Teddy.
To take you back to Borg in the arena, there was a subtle indication he would give Mariana, and this is the God's own truth, and she would have to stand up and leave the stadium. It was a raised eyebrow, it was a flick of the hair across the forehead, a snap of the headband, or it was a ping off his racket in a particular way, and Mariana would dutifully get up and tramp her way outside the stadium and sit and have five or six cigarettes and just wait for Bjorn and wait to hear the roar of the crowd. Bjorn was very popular. And the roar of the crowd, and she knew by the distinct roar of the crowd whether he'd won or lost.
So she wouldn't come back in once she'd been sent out?
She tried a couple of times, but security were having none of it. She smelt of smoke, and they used to search her for incendiary devices. They were detailed searches. I don't think she enjoyed it much. But, you know, having said that, you know how I feel about Bjorn, both Bjorn and Mariana. They're wonderful people. And, you know, I think that, well, looking back, I think perhaps he was a little hard on her.
Yeah. Teddy, tell me about the one time that Mariana decided not to obey Bjorn and leave.
Oh, well, yes. It was in the 1980 US Open. And we know now that Bjorn needed to win that match in order to run for the Grand Slam at the Australian Open later that year. He was playing Johnny Mack again.
Yeah.
It went to five sets. You know, an incredible statistic here. Exactly the same number of games in the Wimbledon final.
Well, there you go.
Isn't that an amazing statistic? Mm. Now, somewhere in that fourth set, and I can't tell exactly where, but I was there, And I saw Bjorn. He just sort of flicked at his earlobe. I thought, well, hello, something's up here. And he glanced up. Mariana, nothing. Now, they had just been married, and I wonder to this day, Mariana was flexing her marital muscles.
Trying to assert herself?
So she sat there, glued to a seat.
And I believe Leonard Berglund, Borg's coach, started trembling.
Oh, he was a trembler.
He didn't know where this was going to end.
He nudged her in the elbow, and she just pretended not to see Berglund. She did that quite often to Leonard Berglund. He would walk into a room, and she would try to walk through him. They would bump into each other. It was terrible. But in this case, she held her ground. Now, when Borg lost the fifth, and he glanced up again, well, I'm surprised the stadium was still standing.
It would have been grounds for divorce, I would have thought.
Well, I think perhaps a couple of years later, it came home to roost. And if she had only got up and walked out, I wonder if their lives had been materially different, if tennis history had been materially different. I don't know. I don't know the answer to these questions.
It's an interesting point, Teddy. And to me, it perhaps clarifies where the death threats to Borg came from in 1981.
You think perhaps they came from America? Well,
all the FBI reported was that somebody with a smoker's cough was making the threats.
Well, that could have been me. I hope you're not pointing the finger at me. You're pointing at Mariana, obviously.
Teddy, I really would like to point the finger at nobody in particular.
Well, it's a sad story the way it ended, all in all. And perhaps life does come down to one or two moments.
I think on that wonderfully profound moment, Teddy, we might leave it there.
Thank you, Rima, and God bless you.
Talk about super fans. Wherever professional tennis player Serena Williams goes, one can bet that Beyonce and her husband Jay-Z will be there cheering her on. The couple was present at Wimbledon in July, and they both recently witnessed Williams compete in the U.S. Serena invited Beyonce to the U.S. Open herself, saying, "Usually when people are there, I try to play better, especially if they're famous and they're doing so great at their job." The support goes both ways for the friends. Serena also appeared in Beyoncé's Sorry music video.
It's interesting that over the last few years, Remo, it seems to be a pattern that celebrities are making an appearance in the box and that players want them in the box.
I personally think it would just add to the pressure of playing your match. That's just me. Obviously, some players perhaps perform when they're being watched by somebody famous. Brings the best out in them.
What always surprises me is when they have a famous sports person in the box. Roger Federer has had Tiger Woods and Michael Jordan in his box. Now, obviously he sees them as peers, which they are. But you've got two guys who are the greatest in their field of all time, arguably.
Yeah.
It must be an incredible confidence to be able to pull it off with them watching you and not second-guessing yourself or thinking, well, you know.
What about if you look up and Jordan looks bored? Wouldn't that put you off? Would you feel that you need to do something because the great one is yawning, he's bored, he's more interested in his popcorn?
Don't you think, though, that a sports person would be hyper aware of what his or her responsibilities are in the box?
Not when you're that famous. That you don't care.
You don't care anymore?
No. Yeah, you rule the world.
If Federer looks up and there's Tiger Woods sitting with his back to him.
Jordan's got his feet up, reading a magazine.
Now, it's interesting we say expectations because I remember in the 2008 Wimbledon final between Federer and Nadal, Gwen Stefani and her partner were watching. It was a five setup with rain delays. And I think you know what I'm going to bring up here, Remo. Gwen Stefani looking bored during one of the greatest tennis matches ever played.
Yeah, while a partner is lurched forward on the edge of his seat, punching a hole into the front of the player's box.
Yeah, there are times where he jumps up and punches the air and you think he's going to go over.
It's quite funny, actually, watching.
And she's there sort of looking down and not into it at all, thinking, when is this thing going to finish? Not a good look for Gwen Stefani.
No, especially based on one of the greatest matches of all time. And she can't, you know, raise more than passing interest in it. I actually enjoyed watching that sometimes during some of the dead spots in that match.
Exactly. Some people go into the box. The box can celebritize. Do you like this word? Celebritize people.
It's almost as good as protocolize.
Really? I think it's sort of par. For example, Stacey Margolin, 1980 Wimbledon final.
Yeah.
That was in the early days of celebrity in the box. She wasn't a celebrity. She was a tennis player. She was John McEnroe's girlfriend at the time. But she became somewhat famous for being in the box during that match.
You say Stacey Margolin to me, and I immediately think of young girl with blonde hair leaning off to the side, sighing after that tiebreak ends. Yeah. And that's an image that stays with me as soon as you mention those words.
There's another one where she looks down at Borg's partner, Mariana, and as she's just looking at her from behind and checking out her reaction to something. Interestingly, though, the next year, John McEnroe, in a press conference at Wimbledon, was asked about Stacey Margolin. They had broken up.
Yeah.
In the press conference after McEnroe had left, there was a fight between two journalists because one of the journalists accused another journalist of crossing the line, of being insensitive. And an actual fist fight broke out. Now, this is over Stacey Margolin, who the year before was in the box in that match.
And McEnroe had nothing to do with the fist fight.
Surprisingly not.
I can't believe that. Okay, celebrities are one thing. What about players inviting people outside of celebrities? Are they allowed to invite outside of family members and people in their entourage and celebrities? Why don't we ever see other types invited into the box?
Like when you say other types, what do you mean, Remo?
For example, say Dominic Thiem wanted to invite his butcher into the box. He's enjoyed his sausages and cuts of sirloin over the years and say, you know what? I want to invite you into the box.
But how would we know that he hasn't invited? I mean, unless the guy's there sharpening knives with a bloody apron on, how do we know?
Look, I think if you do your homework and who's going to be attending, I think it would be wonderful to cut to the Wimbledon box. And there's John Barrett and his dulcet tones working through the entourage. We'd have the trainer. There'd be the coach, the stringer, a couple of family members. And then maybe there's Jaime Glickstein, Jim Courier's dry cleaner. Now, wouldn't that break up things beautifully?
Break it up beautifully, but not only that, you said before that tennis players are great copycats.
Mm.
And you just have other tennis players bringing in their local, you know, news agent, dry cleaner, butcher, as we've said, local takeaway. Yeah, it'd become ridiculous. Yeah. You'd have this potpourri of people. It'd actually be very, very differentiated.
Are you telling me that that wouldn't bring in a wonderful sense of egalitarianism to a place like Wimbledon?
Doesn't it need it?
Oh.
I mean, God, that needs it big time.
That's a podcast in its own.
In itself.
Mm.
Now, another kind of celebrity, and we talked about the fellow sports person, there's one incident I want to bring up. In the 1990 Wimbledon final between Boris Becker and Stefan Edberg, Becker walked out. He looked up at his box, and there was Katarina Witt, who was a famous ice skater. She was a friend, I think, of Becker's coach or a family member.
Mm.
Didn't know Becker well. Becker said it threw him at the start of that match because he could only imagine that the tabloids would be matching them up, and it was going through his head. Edberg started that match like a house on fire. I don't know if you've seen it, but his volleying was so sensational in that match. But Becker said he just wasn't there for it. He lost the first two sets. It ended up going to five. Becker lost. But he has come out and said it had a material effect on his psychology to see her in the box.
And I'm sure Becker would have had words to whoever it was that invited her in.
Then again, what did Becker do? We both know what Becker did.
That's right. Famous incident when he was playing Andre Agassi. I guess he was perhaps the first player to use the player's box as part of his strategy. If I've got the facts correct, he was pretty much taking a pummeling from Andre Agassi in a match and at one point blew a kiss to Brooke Shields.
Who was Andre Agassi's either partner fiancé or wife at that point?
At the time. A very smart tactic. Some people would argue that it was totally against the spirit of the game. But again, the player's box coming into its own.
Yeah, and having an effect on the game.
Most certainly.
So celebrities, they're not only sporting celebrities, who you kind of imagine to have Michael Jordan in your box, that's understandable. Yeah. To have Beyonce and Jay-Z is another level, it's another thing. That's Serena Williams has brought that into the women's game.
Yeah, yeah. Andre Agassi with Barbara Streisand. Admittedly, Streisand was under the impression that Andre Agassi was actually Butch Buchholz, and nobody had the nerve to correct her, but it doesn't matter. She was still there supporting who she thought was a wonderful zen-like player.
He's very, very intelligent, very, very sensible, very evolved, more than his, you know, linear years. He's an extraordinary human being. He plays like a Zen master.
How about this idea, Remo, that Caroline Wozniacki once had Donald and Melania Trump in the box?
Is this true?
This is true. And didn't know who they were. So it begs the question, why were they in the box? Who invited them? I mean, we know Trump's a great golf fan. a player and fan. We know that. So it's not like he's not into sport at all. It'd be very interesting to look at some footage of that match, and I haven't been able to find any to show Donald Trump.
You don't think it was likely that Trump just barged his way in there?
Could be. Just said, I'm Donald Trump, this is my seat, I'm not sure. And this is before he was president. That would have made the news otherwise. It would have been there.
Yeah, so. I don't think it makes an iota of difference. I think it's the sort of thing that Trump would have done, would have just sat there and dared people to throw him out.
Buzz?
Yeah.
I got to thank you, mate. I don't know how you did it, but you got us some seats here that are absolutely mouth-watering.
You know how I did it?
How?
I clicked the subscription button.
So if anybody out there listening just clicks that button, they'll be guaranteed seats in a player's box at one of the four majors. Is that what you're saying? Have I got that right?
It's absolutely not what I'm saying.
I'm here with a face that you might recognise. He's one of the most photographed people in Wimbledon who's not a tennis player. This is David Spearing, and he is the longest serving honorary steward. And this is the place where the players, family, relatives, their coaches sit, is that right?
Yes, correct, yes.
And this is an area that you're in charge of, I understand.
Yes, for the past 12 years or so,
right.
Of that order now.
You are here for 2 weeks per year, but you don't spend your whole life in Wimbledon, I understand.
No, I fly back every year from Abu Dhabi in the Middle East. But, I mean, my greatest pleasure is the people, really. I love it.
Now, I'm sure we've all seen him. He's been there for some of the greatest moments in history at Wimbledon. He is the gentleman in the player's box wearing the distinctive black cowboy hat. I was intrigued when I saw him year after year. And I remember by saying to you, who is this guy? What do we know about this gentleman?
Well, we know he's been a steward at Wimbledon since 1976. He's been in the box since 97. But he owns a structural engineering company in Abu Dhabi. And he comes out to Wimbledon once a year. That's his only tennis foray in the year, if you like. Now, let me just backtrack a little bit here, Remo, because... One of the reasons we're talking about this guy is not because he's seen a lot. It's because he's seen a lot and his appearance.
Mm.
It just seems quite strange with that black Stetson on
and
that little white beard he has.
Goatee.
He could come from somewhere in the Wild West. He seems out of kilter with the All England Tennis Club. If it wasn't for the hat, I don't think we'd be having this conversation.
No, you're right. But even the details you've provided, we read these details and we just accept them. It doesn't make sense.
What, you mean the structural engineer thing and the...
Yeah, he's an honorary steward. He comes out once a year. He's obviously quite wealthy. He's got his own company. He gets this gig of sitting in that box. Look, please, how do you get a job like that?
I don't know. How do you fall into that?
Yes.
I can't answer that question. I wish I could, but I can't answer it.
Yeah, and apparently he wanted a different hat.
Well, he wanted a different hat and they just gave him that one and said, wear that one, son. Mm.
He wanted a Roman centurion helmet, apparently.
The first time I saw him and noticed him was in the Borg McEnroe 1980 final. We talked about Stacey Margolin. We talked about Marianne, Borg's partner. But there's this guy at the end of the box.
Mm.
Exactly. What's he doing there? Is there a fight going to break out? Let me just point something out that we haven't mentioned in this podcast, at Wimbledon in particular. In the earlier years, the players' entourage sat behind each other.
Yeah.
So you'd have, in that match, for example, you had Borg's entourage at the front, McEnroe's at the back. These days, I believe they're separated.
Mm.
And that's a big difference. A big difference in etiquette.
Yeah.
Because you know that at the end of the matches, they would turn around and shake hands and be nice to each other. These days, there's a separation. I think that there's been a slight breakdown in etiquette in terms of the way the boxers, maybe not so much Wimbledon, but it's certainly in other tournaments. You know, there have been players who have reacted to the way the boxers catcalling them or saying things to them. But yeah, in those early days, so he would sit at the end. Maybe it was just as a... Or is he going out getting them drinks? Is he making sure they have what they have? What does a steward do?
It could be. Really, what a privileged position he has been in. Could you imagine over the years what he must have heard, what he must have felt in that box? And I wonder if anyone's floated the idea of him writing a book.
I can see a movie.
Oh, I think a movie or a book, like
a musical.
Out of the box.
Yeah.
He could list perhaps the saltiest box he's ever been in.
Billy Bob Thornton could play him.
The tension, the most tense box he's ever been in. The most, I don't know, sexually charged box he's ever felt. He'd have categories.
The smelliest box he's ever been. You know,
there'd
he'd
be a
have
chapter,
a
chapter for each box. And are you telling me that people wouldn't read something like that?
I'd walk down the street to buy that right now. And there's not even a bookshop down the street. That's how desperate I'd be for it.
Have we got his number? I really want to float this one, pitch it to him.
Let's get it to him before he's snapped up. Now, Rima, have we covered in this podcast, do you think, the player's box? We could probably go on a lot longer. There's been so many incidents and so many things, but I think pretty much we've covered what we want to cover. What do you think?
I think so. And look, for an area that's quite small in itself, in dimension, I think we've crammed a lot inside that box.
We certainly have. It's overflowing.
Yeah.
But people are falling out of the box.
That's right. And it never looked better.
Exactly. Okay. See you later.
Thank you.